From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. Filmmaker Barry Averich makes a second documentary about Harvey Weinstein after a struggle with a mogul thwarted his first. And with Earth Day coming up, we talk with filmmaker Bill Croyer about the lasting legacy of Fern Gully and its impact on a KPCC colleague.
There's a line at the end of the film that says, for our children's children. I mean, we really had a sense at the time that we were making something that would, we hoped would be timeless, and we also hoped it wouldn't be something that would be a relic of something that disappeared. You know, we didn't want to have it end up being, wow, I wish that was still around.
All that after this break. Earlier this week, the New York Times and the New Yorker shared the Pulitzer Prize for Public Service for their coverage of Harvey Weinstein's history of sexual harassment and abuse. Now, a new documentary aims to continue the conversation. The Reckoning, Hollywood's Worst Kept Secret, premieres next week at the Hot Docs Canadian International Documentary Festival in Toronto. In the film, director Barry Averich interviews actresses Catherine Kendall and Melissa Sage Miller, alleged victims of Weinstein's predatory behavior, as well as former Miramax Films and Weinstein Company employees. Interestingly, this is not Averich's first film about Weinstein. Back in 2011, Averich detailed the former Hollywood power player in a film called Unauthorized, The Harvey Weinstein Project. When I spoke with Averich recently, we started with a story of why that first film never reached a wider audience.
When I first started the film, an ex-Miramax employee said to me, you're going to go through three phases in making a film with Harvey Weinstein and interacting with him. Number one, he's going to be incredibly charming and try to buy you out and suggest that you should make another film and not him, about him. And of course, he did try that. And then the second phase will be that he'll become very belligerent and threaten you. And then the third phase of the world of Harvey Weinstein would be that he would take a bat to your head. The bat to my head in this particular case was the fact that he had IFC Films come to the Toronto Film Festival, look at my film, offer me a lot of money for the film, buy the film, and bury it.
So when you were working on that first film, is there anything about Harvey's behavior or stories that you had heard that you were unable to incorporate into the film that would suggest that there was a ticking time bomb that was going to be revealed later?
Well, I think anybody in Hollywood who has explosive behavior, and he wasn't the only one who has a temper that he did, you know, fights and throwing things and crazy screaming and yelling and threats. Anybody like that, I think, is a walking time bomb. As far as the allegations of sexual harassment on camera, I heard nothing. In many cases, when the cameras would stop rolling, many of my subjects would say, you know, have you heard the rumors? Are you going to cover that in your film? Are you talking about the women? And I would probe them, because certainly I'd be curious as a documentarian, but then they'd stop talking. Or they would tell stories, but they would be off the record. And so any kind of follow-up that I tried from an investigative perspective yielded no fruit, because it's Harvey Weinstein. There was no upside to blowing the whistle on him at that point.
So what happens when the New York Times, the New Yorker, break their stories on Harvey Weinstein last year? That reporting recently won a Pulitzer Prize. Yeah. What was going through your head when you see those stories start to pop up?
Well, I mean, the great irony is that, you know, since he buried the film, he's kept this relationship going with me because he felt guilty. And I was just started production of a film called Prosecuting Evil about the last surviving Nuremberg prosecutor, and the Weinstein Company reached out very aggressively to buy the film from me, and I was very excited about that. And I figured, all right, well, I'll bury the hatchet. Then, of course, the scandal hits, the New York Times, New Yorker stories, double punch hits, and my immediate reaction, aside from getting my film back that they had, was the fact that I needed to go back to my original film, my 2011 film, and relook at the film and put a new third act on it, because life had suddenly changed for Harvey. Now, of course, the scandal widened in breadth, and at that point I decided I wasn't going to re-edit a film anymore. I was going to go back and make an entire new film about not only Harvey, but the entire Me Too movement and where things have gone.
Do you talk to some of the people who have said that they were sexually assaulted or harassed by Harvey?
I did, yes, many.
having been kind of cajoled and bullied and threatened by Harvey, even though you weren't physically or sexually assaulted by him. Do you understand now what these women went through, how he wooed them, how he treated them, and how he tried to penalize them if they spoke out?
I can't begin to understand what it was like to be in a room alone with him, be a woman who is frightened, who is trapped, a large arm in front of them so that they can't, you know, exit. I can't begin to understand any of that. I do now understand why it would take someone so long to speak out. I understand, you know, the machinations of Hollywood and power, and I'm beginning to understand the trauma that, you know, that one might experience in going through that. But I will tell you that having talked to many former Weinstein or Miramax employees, a lot of them, they saw it, they witnessed it. A lot of them thought that that's the way it is in any studio in Hollywood. That's what they thought. So they figured, all right, well, if I quit this company, then I'm going to go and work for the next animal. And that's a shame. You know, the casting couch has been around for a long time, and people assume that that's the way it worked.
A lot has been written, and certainly a lot more will be written about Harvey Weinstein and other sexual predators in and around Hollywood. What do you hope is the takeaway from your new film? What is the new information, new interviews, new perspective that might change or add to the conversation?
My sole purpose in making the film was to immortalize a time in history and to keep the discussion and the debate going. So, you know, listening to the many interviews that I did for this film, learning about why alleged victims repress activity and don't speak, knowing how people interact in their offices, knowing the statistics, how dramatic the statistics are that one in three people are sexually harassed at work. There's somebody that gets sexually harassed every 98 seconds. The whole purpose of my film is to really get a sense of the victims and the abusers, the psychology, what goes on and what has to change.
Barry Averich is the director of The Reckoning, Hollywood's Worst Kept Secret. Barry, thanks so much for coming on the show.
My absolute pleasure.
Now we're going to get a little nostalgic and talk about a film that made a big impression on a lot of kids of the 80s and 90s. And the movie is Fern Gully, The Last Rainforest.
But just think, humans back in the forest.
Yep, there goes the neighborhood.
Be nice, Batty.
First thing, all these trees go. Then come your highways, then come your shopping malls and your parking lots and your convenience stores. And then come...
You might recognize that last voice as Robin Williams. He played a bat character named Batty, who recently had escaped an animal testing facility. Fern Gully takes place in a pristine Australian rainforest and follows a group of fairies and other magical rainforest creatures. Once humans start logging the forest, they unleash a destructive force called Hexus, which threatens to destroy their home. Director Bill Croyer was a former Disney employee who had started his own company to focus on computer animation, and Fern Gully was one of the earliest films to use the new technology. Unlike most movies at the time, Fern Gully, which came out in 1992, had strong environmental themes, and the film had a lasting impact on some young moviegoers, including our own KPCC environment reporter, Emily Guerin. To talk more about Fern Gully, I'm joined now by KPCC's Emily Guerin and Fern Gully director Bill Croyer. Emily and Bill, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Happy to be here.
So before we start talking about the movie, I want to put the film in context. It came out in 1992, which is 26 years ago, and it's really before we were having a national conversation about climate change and melting polar ice caps and incredible weather events. But there was a president in the White House, a Republican, who actually cared about the environment. Let's listen to what President H.W. Bush was saying at the time.
They are home to more than half the world's species. First, I will propose a major new initiative to protect and enhance the world's forests. I mentioned lessons learned about cost effectiveness. Well, halting the loss of the Earth's forests is one of the most cost-effective steps that we can take to cut carbon dioxide emissions.
So, Emily, what is it like listening to that as somebody who covers the environment?
I mean, just to hear a Republican president utter the words, you know, global carbon emissions. It's like takes me to this alternate universe of what if, what would have happened if we had sort of taken that seriously. I mean, President George H.W. Bush, like he did actually do a lot for the environment. He amended the Clean Air Act, you know, one of the foundational environmental laws in our country, to fix the ozone hole, to do something about acid rain, to combat smog in cities like Los Angeles. And so it was just a totally different time. And it takes me back to being, you know, a little 6-year-old and, you know, seeing this film about the rainforest, and it makes me very nostalgic, John.
Bill, I want to ask you a little bit about how this story came to you, what you were doing at the time, and how the original seed for this film was planted.
Well, my wife and I had left Disney and formed a little company called Courier Films. I had been a kind of a pioneer in computer graphics. And I loved the way computers did certain things, but you couldn't do them, you couldn't do character stuff. So I came up with a way to combine hand drawing with computer animation. And we had our little company, Courier Films, where we were doing work, but everybody working for us was ex-Disney people. So we were one of the few companies that actually would be hired by Disney to do title sequences and Epcot shows and things. And these Australian guys had just made Crocodile Dundee and had a lot of heat in Hollywood, and they had a story called Fern Gully, The Last Rainforest, written by the wife of one of the producers, and they came to Hollywood looking to make that as a feature, and they discovered kind of quickly that there were no animated feature companies in Hollywood that made Disney-style features, except Disney, and Disney wasn't going to do it. So they asked around, and they found us, and I'll never forget the day they came into the studio. I think we had 20 employees, and they came in and looked at the reel and came back the next morning and said, "We want you to do the feature."
Did this appeal to you as somebody who was looking for an original story? Did it appeal to you as somebody who cared about the environment? What were your personal connections to the material that they were presenting to you?
I have to honestly say that we were not out to make an environmental picture at the time. We hadn't really thought about it. We were in just a commercial studio. And I'll be honest, when they told us the topic, you know, fairies in the rainforest, our hearts kind of like, you know, dropped a little bit. But, you know, I have to say, the minute we started to get into it, the more excited we got. And the big thing for us, of course, was taking the trip to Australia and actually going to the rainforest and spending 3 weeks in the rainforest. That was a life-changing experience for us. And as a result, a life-changing experience for other people.
So a lot of people, including myself, would assume that a story about the rainforest is set in South America, set in the Amazon. But you go to Australia, and what do you see, and how does that influence the movie that you end up making?
One thing you find out right away was that rainforest covered a lot of Australia. And the sad story is that everything you could cut down was almost immediately cut down. So the only rainforests remaining are the ones that were too remote to log. You have to go way up in the mountains, in the Green Mountains, to get there. And they're stunning to see, you know, these huge trees and the interconnected vines. That idea of the web of life is literally right in front of you in the rainforest, where every creature and every plant is really interconnected. The beauty of that and the magic of that made such an impression on all of us that we ended up using it precisely. We hardly caricatured this film. If you really know it, you look into it, every branch, every tree, every animal is exactly as it really is in the rainforest, because we thought, you don't have to fantasize this. If you really learn what it's really like, you'll understand that the world is a magical place. And it's really worth saving.
We're talking with Bill Croyer. He's the director of Fern Gully, The Last Rainforest, and KPCC environment reporter Emily Guerin. Emily, when you are the young person that you are at the time, what do you remember about seeing the film, not just thematically, but personally and emotionally, and why did it connect with you?
Well, I think it is part of what Bill was saying. It's that it was so realistic and so magical. I vividly remember these rainforest scenes and how lush it was, how big the trees were, and how little the fairies were in comparison. I remember how sort of evil the oil villain in the film is, and how angry I was that the oil villain wanted to destroy the beautiful rainforest. And of course, I also remember this character of Batty, who was voiced by Robin Williams. And I literally have had the Batty rap in my head since then, since 1992.
It is going to go back into your head right now, because we're going to listen to Robin Williams singing the Batty rap. We're going to get this earworm restarted in Emily Guerin's mind. So let's listen a little bit to Robin Williams performing.
Yo, the name is Batty. The logic is erratic. Potato in a jacket. Toys in the attic. I rock and I ramble. My brain is scrambled. Rap like an animal, but I'm a man.
Robin Williams is obviously probably winging a fair amount of this. I don't know. But he's also talking about something very serious. He's talking about, like, testing on lab animals. Tell us a little bit about that song and how it came to be in the film.
Batty's kind of the central symbol of the film. You know, he's a natural creature that's been terribly abused without thought by people who think they're doing something for the better. And so it was his character stood out from the very beginning. Picking Robin Williams, knowing Batty was a crazy character who changed personalities every time you touched his wires, we needed a guy who could shift and shift and shift very quickly. And if you ever watch Robin on stage, that's what he does. He was the greatest at doing that ever. So the fit was natural. And I have to say, when we approached him, he was instantly on board. And he made a deal that was unheard of, I think. He donated every cent that he made to the Rainforest Fund, to Sting's Rainforest Fund. And we gave him gross points on the film. So it was I don't know if any performer's ever gotten that. So our film ended up donating millions and millions of dollars to the Rainforest Fund, thanks to Robin.
And I think it's important to know, too, this is before he made Aladdin. So Robin Williams as a voice actor in animated features was kind of an untested experiment.
That's true. We really had no doubt that he would do a good job, but I think that it was remarkable to watch him work. You know, we'd always have the storyboards in the recording room, right? And he would look at the sequence, he would do what was written in the script, and he'd instantly get the moment, and then he'd start to ad-lib. And the problem is that he did 50 things that were brilliant. And the challenge was going into editorial and trying to figure out which of these things do we use. We've got gold, silver, platinum. How do we take it? And we did hours of stuff, and it's all of it great.
What kind of impact do you think Fern Gully had on you as a journalist? And can you trace some of your interest in covering the environment today back to what you saw so many years ago?
Yeah, I mean, I think because I was so young and because the film's message was so distilled, I mean, it was, here's this beautiful, you know, lush landscape and humans are messing it up. I mean, that was, to me, really was sort of the central theme of the film. I did take that with me as I got older. And of course, it became more nuanced. And as I decided to become a journalist, I increasingly wanted to see the other side. But I think that sort of central question, it had a big impression on me, and especially the theme of the oil industry. I mean, I later went on to live in North Dakota and cover the oil boom.
Bill, how would you assess its impact on the conversation around the environment and people like Emily, who are influenced by it and went on to work in that field?
You know, my wife and I always say that hardly a week goes by that in the 26 years that we don't meet somebody, especially now at Emily's age, that says that I love this film and it really had an effect on me. Another thing that's kind of funny in the opposite way is for years I got hate mail from logging companies and from logging lobbyists saying, you're against logging and logging is necessary, you know, never realizing that those things are not incompatible. You know, if you there are ways to harvest logs and to replant forests and things that are better than tearing them out and ripping them out. So we were never actually against logging. But I think you have to look at the positive side and how it awoken people again, what it is that they may not be there themselves, but that's what you do in film, right? It's a vicarious experience. You bring people to a place they couldn't be. You give them an experience they couldn't have. And that was the thing we really tried to do. And by doing that, I think we have had a lasting effect. And it's still there. Anyone watching it today will have that same feeling, I think.
Now let's get back to my conversation about the 1992 animated film Fern Gully with KPCC environment reporter Emily Guerin and Fern Gully director Bill Croyer. The film was based on a series of short stories written by producer Wayne Young's former wife, Diana Young, and it was one of the first films to employ computer animation, thanks to technology that was developed by Fern Gully director Bill Croyer. Unlike other animated films of the time, Fern Gully tackled the serious issues of deforestation and environmentalism, and those themes influenced an entire generation of kids. And though Croyer says the film wasn't trying to be preachy, its makers did know that they were promoting an important message.
There's a line at the end of the film that says, for our children's children. I mean, we really had a sense at the time that we were making something that we hoped would be timeless, and we also hoped it wouldn't be something that would be a relic of something that disappeared. You know, we didn't want to have it end up being, wow, I wish that was still around, you know. I mean, we really had that, I think we did have that feeling. when you start out, it's like Truffaut said, you know, you start to make a certain kind of movie, and when you're into it, you just want to make the movie because you get, there's a lot of work and a lot of trouble, and you always have disasters making a movie. But I don't think it ever left us that there was something really special about this particular film or this particular subject.
So, Emily, that does mean that when you have kids, you have to show them Fern Gully.
Well, there might be a Fern Gully of a new generation, because I actually think that for now, sort of the rainforest, we've sort of moved on from that as an issue. And I think it's interesting that you keep bringing up, Bill, that you got sort of hate mail from logging companies, because I think actually for me, the takeaway wasn't that we're logging the rainforest to death. It was more the power of the oil industry and the sort of oil as the quote unquote villain, which I know that in the early 90s, you know, we were having a lot of discussion about logging and the rainforest and the timber wars in this country. But now we're talking a lot more about climate change and fossil fuels. So in some ways, I think the issues have changed. So I wonder if you were making a Fern Gully now, if it would be set in the ice caps, for example, and the polar bears would be the characters instead of the rainforest creatures.
You know, and Batty was used as a symbol against animal experimentation. You know, he became, I just saw a thing on Facebook the other day where some kid made a full-size Batty costume, and they were protesting, you know, in the environment. So he still stands as a symbol for that. To answer your question, I don't know. I think that those particular characters and their experience were so intrinsically linked to that, to the rainforest, that for that particular story. And again, we didn't really set out to make specifically an environmental thing, but it just became so natural to the subject matter that it emerged.
Emily, I know we've already put one earworm back in your mind, but we're going to give you two because I think that's the gift that we can offer you on the frame. So let's listen to one more song from Fern Gully.
Oil and grime. Sludge, diesel, clouds, and noxious muck. Slime.
So that is Tim Curry, right? And I think what we should remember is that he is singing this song about toxic sludge just a couple of years after the Exxon Valdez has run aground in Prince William Sound and caused catastrophic damage to the environment.
We weren't consciously referencing that. It was just the fact that these logging, that the oil and logging seemed to be, you know, two things that were so tied to the environment, it came natural that we'd kind of combine them into the villain. And that sequence, by the way, was really great. It was animated by Kathy Zielinski, one of the greatest women animators, and storyboarded and art directed by Ralph Eggleston, who went on to become Pixar's great art director, won the Oscar for the Birds. So the talent in that particular sequence especially was really quite exceptional, and it's made a memorable thing. People, again, today still use hexes for T-shirts and things as the iconic symbol of that kind of evil.
So how did Tim Sexton, your music supervisor, go about putting together such an eclectic mix of songs and styles, and how did it all kind of fit together with the artists that you ended up using as well?
You know, the variety of people who wrote the songs and who sang the songs, I give a lot of credit to Tim on that, because we sat down with him and we went through the whole story and we said, these are moments where you could have a song, but to not stop the movie, let's have the song be about this and convey something and move it along. And if you go through the movie and, you know, all those songs from, you know, Life is a Magic Thing and all those things, they really are working with the tone and the content of the story. And, you know, with Jimmy Buffett writing, and you had Tone Loc singing, and you had such a wide variety of artists, I think that was unusual for a soundtrack. I think to this day, it's hard to find a collection of such different musical talent working on one film. It's a really terrific little soundtrack.
Everybody who works on a movie wants to do certain things. They want to have a big box office hit. They might want to win an Academy Award. But is there a different kind of satisfaction when a film becomes part of a cultural conversation? When you see somebody like Emily, whose life was really changed by seeing the movie that you made, does that give you a different sense of accomplishment?
I feel it does. I think as an artist, I always tell my students, you know, the only way you can really be successful is to do what you truly love doing. If you love doing it and you commit yourself, don't rely on the critical reaction or the audience reaction. You have to really believe in what you're doing yourself. This movie was such an easy thing to love. You know, we could tell from the beginning that everybody, to this day, we have a reunion. We're one of the few movies that has cast reunions every 5 years. We have all the artists that come to our house, and there's just a special affection for this movie that I've never seen in any other project, and everybody who worked on it will say that. And I think a lot of it's the topic and the subject matter seem to bleed into the crew and bleed into the process and make it a very special thing.
And Emily, had you seen Raging Bull at age 6 instead of Fern Gully, who knows what you'd be doing now?
John, who knows?
Bill Croyer is the director of Fern Gully. Emily Guerin is the environment reporter at KPCC. Bill and Emily, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, you.
Jen.
On Earth Day this Sunday, there will be a free screening of Fern Gully, The Last Rainforest at 11 a.m. at the Hammer Museum in Westwood. And that's our show for today. You can look for us on Twitter and Facebook. You will find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
Falling like starlight, it's raining like magic.